Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 1183 of the Juice Box Podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome back. We got another episode of Ask Scott and Jenny here. Not much more to say than that. There's listener questions, and Jenny and I try to answer them. While you're listening, please remember that nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan or becoming bold with insulin. You want to help? It's easy. If you're a U.S. resident, you have type 1 diabetes, or you're the caregiver of someone with type 1, you can advance type 1 diabetes research by completing the survey at this link, t1dexchange.org/juicebox. That easy. 10 minutes. And just like that, you're part of what's propelling us forward. Don't forget to save 40% off of your entire order at CozyEarth.com. All you have to do is use the offer code JUICEBOX at checkout. That's JUICEBOX at checkout to save 40% at CozyEarth.com. You should go join the private Facebook group for the Juice Box Podcast. Juice Box Podcast. Type 1 Diabetes on Facebook. Everyone's welcome. That's just the title. There's links in the show notes and links at JuiceBoxPodcast.com. Check it out. Fantastic community. I'm sorry I went into the deep voice there, but it's really great. This show is sponsored today by the glucagon that my daughter carries, Gvoke HypoPen. Find out more at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. US Med is sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast, and we've been getting our diabetes supplies from US Med for years. You can as well. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or the number, get your free benefits check, and get started today with US Med. Today's episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes, a company that's bringing people together to redefine what it means to live with diabetes. Later in this episode, I'll be speaking with Jalen. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 14. He's 29 now. He's going to tell you a little bit about his story, and then later at the end of this episode, you can hear my entire conversation with Jalen. To hear more stories with Medtronic champions, go to MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or search the hashtag Medtronic Champion on your favorite social media platform. Hey, Jenny, welcome back to another Ask Scott and Jenny episode. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yay.
I'm going to start where we left off in the last one. But we're just not going to parse words, and we're going to jump right into it, because I think we talked around it a little bit last time.
I think last time we ended because we thought it was a little bit longer discussion than we had time left or something, if I remember.
About statins?
I don't remember exactly what it was, but, oh, yes.
Yeah, it was statins. So.
Oh, that's right, and I give my opinion at the end.
You did. You got a little crazy. So, like, I like it, and I want to dig a little deeper into it. So, listen, at the beginning of every one of these episodes, it's going to tell you, this is not medical advice. You know, talk to your doctor. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Right. No.
But you started to dig into it a little bit the last time. Once they get the okay to use the medication, now it's something that just gets distributed. Like, you know, oh, you have diabetes? Here's a statin. Even if you don't show any reasons to be on a statin. That's happening now in a lot of practices, right?
Right. I mean, and that was the baseline for my concern with it's given out almost like, well, just take this. That's in a general sense, right? Mm-hmm. You have this condition, type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And that has predisposed you to these types of things. And so we are trying to be preventative. They're calling it preventative, right? In prescribing something like a statin. When in the case of actual individual looking, you can see that somebody's already got the lifestyle habits that are preventative. Mm. It's such a hard thing to navigate recommending being in a medical field to say, just because you have diabetes doesn't mean you have to be on a statin.
So I understand where it comes from. If there's so many people for so long who have such poor care and they all eventually end up with, you know, something that requires a statin, why don't we just paper the community with it and keep it from happening? But that's like saying that a house burns down once a month in our town. So every night I have to go outside and hose my house off before I go to sleep. Like, it's a strange decision to make, I think. And mm-hmm. now if it saves the person, then I guess it was a great decision, you know, but is that the, I mean, we don't want to glance over your point about there are going to be some people who are going to lead a lifestyle that will never lead to elevated levels.
Correct. And that's where, you know, in terms of just blanket prescribing this as a medication, there are some standards that are followed. Obviously, there have to be. And they're not just prescribed solely on like blood tests mm-hmm. anymore. Right. There are parameters that are looked at. There are health risks, you know, even some stats that are being put together by data collection systems that say this suggests that this person is at this percent of a risk based on these other conditions that are already present mm-hmm. or their health factors or inclusive of lab values and all of those types of things. Those are considered, you know, in terms of heart attack risk and stroke risk. Really, those are the reasons that statins are going to be prescribed. But when we talk about diabetes, they're also being prescribed, as I said, preventatively.
Yeah. So then that gets into the next question. We have a bulk of questions here from people. Should I be on a statin if my lipids are okay? What about my numbers are good, but they still want me to be on a statin? Can we please get someone to talk about statins and whether LDL is really a reliable indicator of heart risk, as some doctors would have you believe? So that's the next thing, right? Like, can't you just genetically be predisposed to a higher value, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to turn to something, or is that not the case?
So they look at ratios as well, right? So it's not just total cholesterol anymore. They've broken it down into different measurements. LDL, you know, you can easily remember LDL versus HDL. LDL is lousy cholesterol. That's the one that you want to be lower. Mm-hmm. HDL is your healthy cholesterol. That's the one you want to be higher, right? So it's kind of easy to remember. But in terms of that, when they look at ratios, they're also looking at cholesterol and LDL and cholesterol and HDL ratios. And they're looking at even VLDL, which is very low density sort of lipoprotein, another component of your total lipid panel. And all of these pieces, along with the other conditions that you might be living with, smoking, drinking, you know, lifestyle activity, all of those things have to go in when you're considering the potential of prescribing.
What about having diabetes makes this worse? So if I have a high, lousy, you know, LDL, the doctor looks at me and between the blood work and his assessment, her assessment, it looks like I'm going to end up with actual problems from this. What are those actual problems and how did diabetes make it worse?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of diabetes, remember blood sugar is the thing we're trying to manage. Blood sugar being too elevated for lengthy periods of time or ongoing higher blood sugars than are with a where a body without diabetes would be, it's kind of like rust on a car, mm-hmm. right? So the more sugar you've got in your bloodstream that shouldn't be here causes damage in your vessels. It can cause damage on nerve cells and all of the different little vessels in your eyes, et cetera. Thus, all of the complications in those areas. But the more elevated the blood sugars are, the more damage. And so then the body has to try to repair that damage. It comes in the form of patches or almost like band-aids inside of the vessels.
Right.
And that comes from liver's production of cholesterol. It's trying to help. The body is a self-healing machine. Mm-hmm. It's trying to help itself get better, right? But you're not helping it with high blood sugars. So that's where it comes in. The more optimal blood sugar management you have, the less or likely no damage that you're causing on the interior parts of your body. And so there is where that risk factor should really be considered. Your blood sugars are well managed. You've got an A1C well within target, or you've got, you know, a very low standard deviation, which means you don't have a lot of ups and downs and you're well within range. You've got lifestyle that proves all of the things that you're doing, you're at very low risk. Mm-hmm. For anything like that. So then, you know, I mean, statin drugs, essentially, they lower cholesterol liver levels by essentially decreasing the liver's enzyme output of a particular type of little substance that it kind of puts out.
Okay.
Which is kind of something that goes along then with cholesterol production in the body.
Now, you would take one if you needed it, right?
If somebody could prove to me that I had particular risk factors and a lifestyle that was not proving to be preventative enough, I would take what was needed.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. I just want to make sure. I'm not telling people not to do it. I'm telling them that there's some ambiguity. Ambiguity? Yeah. In between, like, what happened basically was it became in vogue to give statins to people with diabetes. And I think it just started to get blended where people are like, oh, you have type 1, take this. And people are like, I have no risk factors that I can see. My blood work's not even bad. And they want me to take this. What should I do? That question comes up all the time. So I'm glad we talked about it.
No, and that's, I mean, it's good to clear up because obviously, you know, if taking it because of risk factors that are there, when you do take it, there is good information that says, you know, your bad or your LDL cholesterol can be reduced. Mm-hmm. It helps to decrease that buildup or that plaque development kind of inside of the walls of your vessels. I mean, all of those types of things can be mitigated by using it, but it's really in terms of whether or not it's necessary.
Yeah.
If it isn't, then why are you adding something to the mix that could actually have? I mean, another question that probably comes up is, what are some of the side effects?
Yeah, if I take this and I don't need it, like, because it's always a give and take with a medication to some level, right? You're gaining something, you might be losing somewhere else. You got to decide where the value is. If you take insulin or sulfonylureas, you are at risk for your blood sugar going too low. You need a safety net when it matters most. Be ready with Gvoke HypoPen. My daughter carries Gvoke HypoPen everywhere she goes because it's a ready-to-use rescue pen for treating very low blood sugar in people with diabetes ages 2 and above that I trust. Low blood sugar emergencies can happen unexpectedly, and they demand quick action. Luckily, Gvoke HypoPen can be administered in 2 simple steps, even by yourself in certain situations. Show those around you where you store Gvoke HypoPen and how to use it. They need to know how to use Gvoke HypoPen before an emergency situation happens. Learn more about why Gvoke HypoPen is in Arden's Diabetes Toolkit at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. Gvoke shouldn't be used if you have a tumor in the gland on the top of your kidneys called a pheochromocytoma, or if you have a tumor in your pancreas called an insulinoma. Visit gvokeglucagon.com/risk for safety information. Diabetes comes with a lot of things to remember, so it's nice when someone takes something off of your plate. US Med has done that for us. When it's time for Arden's supplies to be refreshed, we get an email. Rolls up and in your inbox says, "Hi Arden, this is your friendly reorder email from US Med." You open up the email, it's a big button that says, "Click here to reorder," and you're done. Finally, somebody taking away a responsibility instead of adding one. US Med has done that for us. An email arrives, we click on a link, and the next thing you know, your products are at the front door. That simple. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. I never have to wonder if Arden has enough supplies. I click on one link, I open up a box, I put the stuff in the drawer, and we're done. US Med carries everything from insulin pumps and diabetes testing supplies to the latest CGMs like the Libre 3 and the Dexcom G7. They accept Medicare nationwide, over 800 private insurers, and all you have to do to get started is call 888-721-1514 or go to my link, usmed.com/juicebox. Using that number or my link helps to support the production of the Juice Box podcast.
Right. Yeah.
Well, speaking of that, let's jump into this very next one. This person said, "I've been listening to the episodes on GLP." So they're talking about my weight loss diaries.
Oh.
So I started off by going Wegovy. So I called it Wegovy Diaries. Very recently, it's changed over to Zepbound Diaries. But I decided I'm just going to call it weight loss because I don't know if Zepbound's going to be the last GLP I use or what. So this person says, "I know what you've said about Wegovy and meds like that being much more frequently used maybe one day for type ones. And can you go into that a little bit?" They also said, "You know, I also hear rumblings about people worried that it causes gastroparesis." So, okay. Again, not a doctor. But here's my view of it. And Jenny has one too, because she's worked with people who are using GLPs of type one.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I started with for myself. So I sit here before you today, 47 pounds lighter than I was exactly a year ago.
Wow.
It's crazy, right? And Jenny can tell you, she looks at me probably more than anybody else. I look really different.
You do.
Yeah. Yes. So I don't have type 1 diabetes. I started with Wegovy, which is just Ozempic. Mm-hmm. To be clear for people, Ozempic is a medication that was FDA approved for people with type 2 diabetes. During the trials, I think they looked at each other and are like, wow, people are losing a lot of weight on this. And so they moved over and did another trial for just weight loss. That drug's called Wegovy. Yes. That's Novo Nordisk. Eli Lilly has Mounjaro, type 2 diabetes, same idea, Zepbound for weight loss. Mounjaro and Zepbound are a GLP with a GIP. Wegovy is just a GLP. And by the way, the other day I saw news about Novo working on a daily pill to step in for the weekly injection. And they seem very excited about what they're seeing in trials for that. Now, all that aside, I don't have diabetes. So I take it. It tells your brain you're not hungry. It makes your stomach feel full by slowing your digestion, which impacts your insulin usage. I've had a number of other valuable things happen, but I watched it work for me. And then I cajoled my brother, who is a type 2. And I was like, hey, man, come on. So he did it. His A1C dropped 2 points.
Which is huge.
The sevens into the low fives is a type 2. He lost 35 pounds. But then I started talking about it on the podcast. And so now a week or so ago, I interviewed the mother of a 13-year-old type 1 who had had type 1 has had type 1 diabetes for 3 years, legitimately has type 1 diabetes, who on Wegovy for weight loss, probably not why she took it. She probably took it more because, this is going to sound convoluted for a second, the mom has PCOS, the daughter is showing signs of PCOS, and GLPs are showing signs of helping women with PCOS.
Correct.
So she was able to get it through her insurance because of the weight. She really wanted it for the PCOS. And I'm not kidding you that yesterday the mom sent me a 90-day clarity report. 90 days. The kid has not bolused for a meal in 90 days.
Wow.
And her total daily insulin has gone from 70 units to 7.
And it's only basal then.
She took her pump off even. Yeah, she's just shooting basal. I'm going to pull it up so I can, because I have it right here, because it's still in my messages.
Again, and for clarification too, you know, from a listener standpoint, this is a very specific case of multiple components being in the picture, that it's not the solution.
No, this little girl's probably has a very slow onset that just didn't look like a slow onset because of insulin resistance, is my guess, right?
Yes.
But you're not going to have had diabetes for 30 years, and drop your insulin use as 90%, but you might drop it a little bit. So,
or even more than a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I've, again, in personal use, not personal me, but personal with the people that I've worked with who have used it, that a number of people who've had diabetes 20 plus years who have started use of it, and their insulin needs, as well as that appetite suppression piece that goes along with it, is very definitely, it's something that the medication brings into the picture.
Yeah.
People whose insulin needs have gone down. One of the women I work with, her insulin needs went down 50%.
Yeah, that's
with not even a therapeutic dose.
Oh, so Arden, my daughter, is doing the same thing. She's only using right now 0.5 milligram of Ozempic a week. Her basal went from 1.1 during the day to 0.85. Her insulin sensitivity went from 1 unit moves her 43 to 1 unit moves her 83. And her carb ratio is now, instead of 1 to 4, it's 1 to 8. And she lost weight. And no, her insulin needs didn't drop because of the weight loss, because the needs dropped before the weight came off.
Before the weight came off. I would imagine the weight eventually came off mainly because it is such an activator in terms of but more of a suppressor, really, I guess, in terms of the digestive impact.
For sure. She's not eating as much. But last thing about this little girl, last 90 days, average blood glucose, 109, GMI 5.9, standard deviation, 23, 98% in range. Range is 65 to 180.
Wow.
I don't know how long that's going to last, but God bless her as long as it does. You know what I mean? Like, fantastic.
Right.
So
I would. Oh, sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
I was just going to remind people that these GLP medications are not FDA approved for type ones, and you're not going to get it through your insurance if you're just a type one.
Right. There have to be some specific diagnostic codes and or reference notes in letters relative to a reason for prescribing mm-hmm. and trying that could get it covered. I know there are a number of people who at least, you know, monetarily have the ability to pay out of pocket for it.
Yeah.
I know a number of people are already also going to Canada.
That's how we're getting Arden. So mine mm-hmm. is covered for me. My wife uses it too, by the way. My wife's story is her own to tell, but I've spoken enough about what happened to my wife when her thyroid went pluey and nobody would give her Synthroid for 7 years. And my wife has been doing this 1 week shorter than I have, and she's lost 70 pounds already.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing.
She's doing so well. She just looks like a completely different person.
And initially, it was very slow for her. Your weight loss was very quick to begin with, and yeah. hers took time, if I remember right.
Yeah, it's different for everybody. And I'm not going to tell you, it's not magic, okay?
No.
I felt, some people call it nausea. I felt like my food stopped somewhere like in my breastbone when I swallowed it. Like it didn't really, but that's the feeling I had. But then I'll say like 3 months into it, it just disappeared. And I really just, I was like, I'm losing weight. I'm powering through this. Like, you know, they kept telling me it's going to get easier. Wegovy, they also say, may have a couple more side effects than Zepbound. It's one of the reasons I moved. I also plateaued. I think I plateaued at 194 pounds on Wegovy. And I was like that for months. Like I would gain and lose the same 2 pounds every week. Mm-hmm. So my doctor moved me to Zepbound where I quickly lost 6 more pounds. Mm-hmm. And then I think I've lost 2 more since then. I've only been on it like 6 weeks or so. I have more weight to go. Like, don't misunderstand. But then do I have to stay on it? People are like, well, you're gonna have to stay on it forever. And here's what I say. I don't care. Like, yeah, if I do, I do. Like, you know what I mean? But I was gonna have a heart attack. So this got to be better, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Well, and in terms of that, as you just brought up, do I have to stay on it forever? I've worked with a couple of women who have used it.
Right now, we're going to hear from a member of the Medtronic Champion community. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes. And this is Mark.
I used injections for about 6 months, and then my endocrinologist in the Navy recommended a pump.
How long had you been in the Navy?
8 years up to that point.
I've interviewed a number of people who have been diagnosed during service, and most of the time they're discharged. What happened to you?
I was medically discharged. Yeah, 6 months after my diagnosis.
Was it your goal to stay in the Navy for your whole life, your career?
It was. Yeah. In fact, I think a few months before my diagnosis, my wife and I had that discussion about, you know, staying in for the long term. And, you know, we'd made the decision despite all the hardships and time away from home. That was what we loved the most.
Was the Navy a lifetime goal of yours?
Lifetime goal. I mean, as my earliest childhood memories were flying, being a fighter pilot.
How did your diagnosis impact your lifelong dream?
It was devastating. Everything I had done in life, everything I'd worked up to that point was just taken away in an instant. I was not prepared for that at all.
What does your support system look like?
Friends, your family, caregivers, you know, for me, the Medtronic Champions community, you know, all those resources that are out there help guide the way, but then help keep abreast on, you know, the new things that are coming down the pipe and to give you hope for eventually that we can find a cure.
Stick around at the end of this episode to hear my entire conversation with Mark. And you can hear more stories from Medtronic Champions and share your own story at MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox.
Sort of prior to preconception time.
Mm-hmm.
And then because it is it's not approved. While there are some studies in the preconception time and in first trimester in those who have type 2 who have continued to use it with results that are interesting, yeah. I'll say. It is not approved in pregnancy. So the idea is if you're going to use it well prior to preconception to gain whatever loss really might be in the picture. I know a lot of women in preconception may have difficulty getting pregnant if weight is a big piece in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And once that part is, you know, down to a more optimal weight for their body, and insulin needs, especially the resistance that's in the picture, oftentimes there. Once the resistance has come down, it really does lead to a more optimal environment to actually allow conception,
yeah.
Which is lovely. But then we end up turning around, as I've seen in a number of women, where we end up needing to refigure settings and doses, because without the medication, your needs will go back up.
Oh, you have no idea. Arden's in the middle of her finals right now. And 3 days ago, I said, did you shoot that GLP? And she goes, oh, I forgot. I'm like, I can see it on your graph already, like in days. So I think it's a once weekly, but I was listening to this doctor online who says that the half-life's about 5 days maybe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I notice it too.
It peters out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So again, from a preconception standpoint, it gives you enough good time to be able to say, okay, I can take it up to this point, can kind of figure things out, trying to conceive, et cetera.
We're at the very beginning of something here with this, because you can find, there's Facebook groups where they talk about having Ozempic babies, like people who could not get pregnant their entire adult lives, go on a GLP and end up pregnant in 2 months.
Right.
Like crazy. There was this crazy thread in Reddit. I know people are like, it's Reddit, but no, it's where people are talking, you know? Mm-hmm. People who have, I never pronounce this right, Jenny, ears, Danlos, what's that autoimmune issue with the joints, ears, Danlos? Why do I never say it right? Hold on a second. It's not very common. Ears, it's
E-H-R-S,
Danlos syndrome. A group of illnesses passed from parent to child known as inherited, affects skin, joints, and blood vessels. It's a very rare condition, right? But there's this group of people. It's like
connective tissue,
yeah,
right?
Like if you can like hyperextend your joints and stuff like that, some people have like real pain from that. And I found this group of people on Reddit who are like, hey, I have this and my symptoms are going away. And the only thing I've done differently is taken a GLP medication. And it got 15 people in the group who are like, oh my God, I thought I was crazy. Like, I think that's happening to me too.
That's interesting.
So inflammation maybe, like who knows where this is all going to like eventually like shake out. All I can tell you is it saved my life, like for sure. And, you know, and what I'm seeing it do for Arden is huge. Mm-hmm. Like, it really is. So I don't know where this is all going to go, but if we wake up in a world one day where you're getting a GLP along with your type 1 diabetes, I'm not going to be surprised when it happens. Yeah.
Right. You know, it always makes me, I had a conversation with a friend the other day, also an educator with type 1 herself, and it just makes me really consider in the grand scheme of things, what have we really shifted so much in our recent, let's say even the past 50 to 75 years of what we're doing, that's something that is naturally produced intestinally, right? That's naturally supposed to be there working the way that we were created in the human body for it to work. Why is it not doing what it's supposed to be doing any longer?
How did we kill it off? Yeah.
How did we kill it off? How did we kill off the function of what, and why for some people is it so necessary? What are people who aren't using it and who find no real reason to even use it? What's the difference?
Yeah.
Like the rabbit hole of thoughts is where this like leads me.
Well, why are there so many autoimmune issues? Why are they so much more frequently? And like, how is this? Listen, Jenny, between you and I think when we start genetically modifying seeds to grow in weed killer, I think maybe you've got part of your answer right there. You know, so
yes,
that's all. I don't know.
I'm glad you said it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if people realize that or not, but they make weed killer and then they genetically modify the seed so that the weed killer doesn't kill the seed, so that you don't actually have to pay someone to go out there and pull weeds to choke out the thing. You just plant the stuff, spray the field, everything dies except the modified seed, and your corn comes up or whatever. And that can't be good for us. I know like people are like, don't cook on Teflon. I don't. Yeah, don't microwave your plastic. I don't. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I try to avoid all that stuff too. But big picture, there are plenty of people who have autoimmune issues and never had a Teflon pan. So I think maybe we're, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's got to be something systemic like that. And so my point is, I would like that fixed. But I also understand that by the time they fix it, I'm going to be dead already.
Yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely. I got to live now.
At that point, you're not going to be dead from heart disease.
Now. Come on, Jane. But I had a stomach that would have been, if I had a heart attack, a doctor would have looked at me and went, huh, yeah, that makes sense. Like, yeah. And now I don't. So maybe I get to live longer.
Make more.
Well, yay. For me. I don't know how good it is for anybody else. Sorry.
It's good for everybody. So, absolutely.
So that's where I'm going to land, is that I've seen a number of type 1s using GLPs at what would not even be considered a therapeutic dose. They're having a lot of gains. Now, look, to the person's last point, it's not for everybody. Nothing's for everybody.
Right.
And there are side effects that are on the label. Gastroparesis, I've seen intestinal blockage, stuff like that. You also don't know where those people were before they started the medication or how they ate right. once they had it. And I'm going to give you an actual example of a person I spoke to in public.
Awesome.
I saw them a year ago. I saw them recently. They've lost a ton of weight. I said, oh my God. We looked at each other and he was like, you lost a lot of weight. I said, you did too. And I said, how'd you do it? And he goes, GLP medication. I said, that's how I did it. And then he goes, how do you like it? And I was like, that's great. I went over everything about it that, you know, pros and cons that I saw. How is it for you? I said, he goes, I vomit all day on it. And I'm like, wait, what? And he starts talking. And then I recognize he's shooting the GLP, but he's eating these high fat, like meals. And like, he's, I don't know. You know, I don't know what to say he's doing. But it's not in the spirit of the idea is what I'm going to get. Like, it's not magic. No. You can't shoot the stuff and then eat a 5-pound bag of sugar and lose weight. It like doesn't work that way. Right.
Right.
He slowed his digestion down. He's had type 1 diabetes for a pretty long time. It was not greatly managed. I don't know what nerve damage he has or doesn't have. Like, sure. So know who you are before you jump into this. But, you know, I don't know. It's just my experience. So
yeah, no, and you bring up a really good point. Overall, you've had success, but I also know, you know, just in our discussions privately, that you do a very good job of awareness in terms of what you eat.
I'm not taxing this situation. Yeah.
You're working with it. I guess that's the thing. It's like anything. You have to work with the system. Even, you know, automated insulin delivery systems, you have to work with the system. It's not going to do everything for you. The same thing with medications in general. Yeah. They're a piece of the pie. Even as we started out talking about statins. Great, I'm on a statin now. I can go out for burger and fries like it because it's going to take... No.
Yeah.
No.
And I know that's it happens a lot more than you might want to believe too.
Yes. Yes.
The number of people who basically told me I eat through my GLP, like, yeah, it tells me I'm not hungry, but that doesn't stop me. I'm like, oh, okay, that maybe see a therapist then. Like, if you're not hungry, you know, and you're still eating, that's right. A different situation. Let's finish this one up because I think this will take a little chunk of time.
Okay.
Exercise.
Oh.
Exercise with type 1 diabetes.
Oh, that's a broad topic.
Yeah, well, let's pick through the three questions I have here. This one was interesting to me. How high of a blood sugar is too high to exercise with? Go ahead. I'm interested in what you're going
to
say.
No, and that's, I'm trying to frame the way to say it.
Because you know, everybody gets told, don't exercise when your blood sugar gets high.
Correct. Yeah. So if we're talking about it just from an angle of overall performance, there were some really good studies done. It was a doctor at the Barbara Davis Center, if I remember correctly. He did studies within the realm of athletes with diabetes and athletes without diabetes and optimized performance mm-hmm. with blood sugars in certain ranges. And what was found is a blood sugar range of somewhere between like 100 and 180 was where performance worked well, right? Their muscle performance, their endurance, and all of that kind of stuff. So in terms of targeting, when you're looking at performance, there's a range to kind of work with. But a lot of people also, as you said, they feel they're also needing to start with a high blood sugar in order to allow the fall that they know is going to happen in their blood sugar. So then comes in the question, well, how high is too high? What should I be looking at? If my blood sugar is 280, do I have to wait for it to come down to get my blood sugar moving? Not necessarily.
Have you heard people talk about that they've been told it's dangerous to exercise with high blood sugars?
Yes. Okay. And that's the clarification there is relative to whether or not there are ketones present. Mm-hmm.
So if there are, so if I have an elevated blood sugar for a long time and I have high ketones, I should not be exercising.
You should aim to clear the ketones and get blood sugar moving. And both of them require insulin.
Okay.
Right? You have to clear ketones. Ketones require some extra hydration, electrolytes, as well as extra insulin to get the ketones to move. Mm-hmm. High blood sugars also require more insulin. So you're kind of adding extra on top of just bringing blood sugar down. And at that point, then, if ketones are present, again, we're talking in a normal realm, not ketosis or whatever you might be living in naturally. You're aiming to get those ketones down. Now, if you check ketones, your ketones are like barely visible or not even there at all, and your blood sugar is 280, go ahead and take a walk.
Yeah, I was going to say, this doesn't mean I can't miss a meal bowls and go for a walk afterwards just because my blood sugar went to 250 or something like that.
Okay, correct. Right. Exactly.
What happens if I exercise with high ketones like that?
So if you exercise with high ketones, the idea is that the way that your body is going to, you're at a deficit of insulin. High blood sugars and high ketones mean that you're operating without enough insulin in your system. And without enough insulin in your system, what ends up happening with when you add exercise, your body is trying to drive energy or glucose into your cells in order to be used. Well, if there's not enough insulin there, even exercising isn't going to help because also the ketones are present.
Okay.
So you can actually make blood sugar go up. It's a huge stress on the body with ketones present, as well as the high blood sugar. Oxygenation also at high blood sugars with ketones changes. Yeah. So you may find effort much, much harder. And there are a lot of things that are the reason that the general recommendation is if your blood sugar is above 250, don't go and exercise. I mean, that's the baseline.
That's a very clear explanation of that, by the way. The best one I've heard so far. I appreciate that.
Oh.
Yeah. No, yeah. Seriously, because I've been janky on it too. Like, people are like, why are you not supposed to? I'm like, well, you're not supposed to if there's ketones, but you can if you're hot. And I'm like, I don't know. It's hard to explain, you know?
It is.
Here's the next exercise question. What are the preferred numbers for exercise or sports when high at the threshold should we let the kids sit? So it would, you said that again, but go over that one. Where do they, what number should they not be running around and where should they be testing ketones at? Is it a number or is it an amount of time high or a little bit of both?
It could be a little bit of both. I mean, high blood sugars, that's the reason that I don't know, most meters and even insulin pumps these days still remind you to check ketones and blood sugar if your blood sugar is being recorded at 240 or greater, right? So that is kind of that level of evaluation. But also, if you are used to running blood sugars that are well within target, and now your blood sugar has been sitting at 200 or 220 for hours on end, it's a good idea to check ketones.
No matter what, yeah.
No matter what, yeah. Right? You know, there are certainly reasons that you could have ketones at lower blood sugar numbers as well. And, you know, in that instance, maybe your blood sugar is high when it normally isn't because you are at a deficit of insulin because your pump site's partly pulled out or it's leaking or something is wrong. I mean, there are evaluation steps along the way that you definitely have to take into consideration.
Yeah.
And, you know, just an hour of a high blood sugar, technically you shouldn't have ketones from an hour of high blood sugar, especially if it's not a pump or a site or an injection issue. It's probably you just didn't bolus enough or you timed it wrong or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So then in exercise, I think another one that kind of always is in the same line here in my thought is, well, what if exercise causes the high blood sugar, right?
Okay. Like lifting?
Like either lifting those anaerobic exercises, right? They drive adrenaline. You might have a quick rise in blood sugar, or over the course of the time that you're lifting, you might have a rise in your blood sugar, which requires insulin. Mm-hmm. Many people find that, especially lifters, they need to take some injected insulin or some bolused insulin with their pump or maybe a temp basal increase or something to accommodate for what's going to happen. Some people, however, and I see this a lot, you know, kids and adults alike, sort of that A game or the race that they've been working so hard and they get there. And all of their training has been well managed. They haven't had high blood sugars or issues, but they get to that like really like packed up energy level of this is my game, and up goes the blood sugar. Right. And what do you do with it, right? Do you correct for it ahead of time, knowing that this is a aerobic exercise and that you will be moving for a fairly long period of time? Do you just let the high happen and then let the exercise bring the blood sugar back down? Mm-hmm. Or does that rise leave you sit high? So you may have to analyze, and this is where some experiential sort of watching to see what should we do.
Figure it out over time.
Yeah.
How good is the blanket advice if you don't want to fall during exercise, try very hard not to have active insulin in your body before you exercise and during. Is that pretty good advice? Like exercise without active insulin, if you can?
If you can.
Right.
That's pretty good exercise. Now, are you completely at a deficit of insulin? No, because you've got basal there.
Yeah. No, I don't mean no basal. I mean, like, don't eat a sandwich 2 hours before you go out and run around.
To have IOB.
Yeah.
In general, that's if you can plan your exercise that way, that's a great way to mitigate not having to snack, mm-hmm. not having to, you know, adjust in another way or having to eat along the way to prevent a drop in blood sugar. Absolutely. That's a great recommendation.
I'm going to throw in one question for myself. How do I mitigate the idea of I've exercised today or played a bunch of games or done something like that, and then I don't get low until like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning? Why does that happen, first of all? Mm. Those kind of like latent lows.
It's called delayed onset hypoglycemia.
Oh, it's got a name.
It's got a name. Dope. You're a Simpsons fan. Delayed onset hypoglycemia. Most people are like, what?
Dope. No, I know what you're saying.
You say it better than I do. But the reason that it happens is, you know, in the aftermath of exercise, this is often exercise that's more around an hour or longer, and often exercise that can be more in the afternoon or the evening. You may see the later hit of the mobilization of insulin and the faster uptake and better use of it mm-hmm. hours after that exercise kind of is finished. And some of the reason you may not see it initially is because afternoon, evening exercise is often coupled with meal or food that comes right after it.
Okay.
And so you may sort of miss the sensitivity that's coming. And exercise, I mean, aerobic exercise especially, I mean, its effect could certainly be 8 to 12 hours.
Yeah.
So I've got one teen that I worked with a while ago, and he was on injections. It worked better than pumping for him. But because of the buildup of activity through the course of his week, mm-hmm. we actually found through testing, we found adjustments in his basal dose that needed to be made by Thursday so that by Friday and Saturday, he wasn't just eating to feed his insulin right. because so much of the activity had built up through the week that he just was needing a lot less.
Yeah. I just spoke to somebody who added swimming to their regimen, and they had to make adjustments to their insulin because they were swimming every day. But then they said, if I miss swimming even a day or so, then my blood sugars shoot up again because their sensitivity changes just from the loss of that.
Yep.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote down two words that you're going to say next. We'll see if I'm right.
Oh,
I'm going to read a question, and then I believe the next words you will utter out loud are these two words. I heard Jenny completed an Ironman marathon. First of all, I think that's an amazing accomplishment. But what did she do to prepare for it diabetes-wise? What did she eat? How did she set her pump? And what do you suggest for longer periods of exercise? And you're going to say...
I tested things.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, half marathon, half Ironman.
That was my first thought. But you are correct. It is... I did a half Ironman.
Yeah. She doesn't want you to think she did a full Ironman when she did a half one. I just thought that was...
Although, I do have to say that my husband did a full Ironman, and I did the majority of training with him. So I guess despite not competing in the actual thing, I did a lot of the training with him.
Could you have done it, do you think? A full?
I could have done it. The funny thing about it is that we were planning kids.
Oh.
And the team that I was planning to do the Ironman with just happened to pick the time frame where we were planning to have kids, and like planning kids and training for an Ironman. Could they go together? There are plenty of people out there who do it. Absolutely. But that was not in my wheelhouse of managing.
Yeah.
So he actually did it with the team that I was going to do it with. But again, along the way, I did a lot of the training. Could I have done it? Yes. I wish that I still had time in my life to do triathlons because they're super fun to train for.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, half Ironman.
Okay.
I've done a couple of full marathons though.
Oh, I imagine. So, yeah.
For clarification. Yeah.
I once saw one on television. Okay. So people are running everywhere.
Yes.
So how did you prepare for it? Like what were the steps you took to get it accomplished?
Yeah. So I already had a fairly good base for running and for biking because I had done enough distance up to the point that I signed up to do the half Ironman the first time. I had done century rides for cycling. Mm-hmm. And I had not yet done a half marathon. I had done 10 milers, but I hadn't done even a half marathon yet. So I had a good base for how my blood sugar needed to be managed and insulin adjustments and fueling for that type of endurance movement.
Yeah.
What I needed to add to it and what was the most trying was adding them all together and learning my adjustment for swimming. The swimming piece of it. Thankfully, wearing Omnipod, I didn't have to take my pump off, right, which made it a lot nicer. But a lot of it was experimentation. It was go in with this expectation based on what I know about my response to movement and do this. And what was the outcome? Mm-hmm. And tracking that. I kept a lot of notes, a lot of records. I kept what worked well in terms of nutrition. Like if I was going to go for a run in the morning, how did my stomach feel when I headed out based on what I had for dinner the night before? What worked well for fueling during long runs and long biking? So all of that had to be then pieced together because you do swim and then you jump on your bike,
right,
and then you run.
So you had to figure out not just how to go into swimming from the day before, but after you did it successfully, now how do I go from that to the next thing? And then when I do those two things in a row, how do I get to the third? Oh, it's a lot of prep months, right? Of figuring it out.
Months, yeah. Absolutely. In fact, my prep started, it was about a year ahead that we had all as a group, we had signed up to do a half Ironman together. We did the Longhorn in Texas. It was a lot of fun.
Okay.
It was very hot.
Yeah.
Although.
Oh, I bet you. And humid too, right?
It was just dry.
Okay.
It was in Austin.
Oh, okay.
But it was mostly dry heat. Yeah. But overall, it's a lot of trial and error. And I think the biggest thing that I found in the endurance part of it was that insulin adjustments for that length of movement, meaning time of movement, was not as much insulin adjustment off in terms of basal. Because what I was filling the space with for maintaining my muscle performance was fuel. Mm-hmm. And that fuel was for a purpose of movement. But when you have diabetes, that fuel also has to work with your blood sugar management plan.
Yeah.
It's a strategy that you definitely, it's beneficial to work with somebody to kind of look at all your records with perspective that's not your own and right, be able to get feedback. But yeah, I found fueling things that worked and fueling things that I was like, oh my God, I can't eat this, you know?
Well, you just made me think of something. I have to say, we eat, you get up in the morning, you eat breakfast, and that fuel keeps you going for a number of hours until you run low and have to put some more back in. But it never occurred to me, I don't know why, to think of it this way, that there's an amount of effort you could put your body through that it needs fuel almost constantly because you can't overfuel it or you won't be able to do the running or whatever you're doing, the activity, but you also can't go large gaps of time without any. So you have, it's little bits along the way. I see. Okay.
Yeah, that was a learning. That's a really good thing just for you to notice in terms of endurance exercise. The way that you end up fueling is not like, oh, it's on the hour. Let me take in 3 goos or whatever you're using, mm-hmm, right? It is, and from a blood sugar management perspective, it's a strategy. I had a watch that had a timer set,
yeah,
and it was a timer for both hydration. It was a timer for my next fuel so that I constantly had the reminder that, oh, it's 15 minutes, it's 20 minutes, it's time for this. And I had it packeted out essentially in the right amounts for the whole time through that long duration of movement.
All right, I'm going to ask you one last question. Don't be embarrassed, okay? I'm going to look away from you when I say it. How much of training for this, how much of the information that you got out of that do you use in other parts of your management? And I'm specifically thinking about sex. Because it seems to me, right? Now, yeah, you're an active person, so I would imagine that I would imagine that there's not a big activity difference between your activity already and you being intimate. But for people who maybe sit around a lot or don't move around as much and then suddenly are working very hard for short spurts of time. I shouldn't have said spurts for short periods of time. Damn it.
I'm sure that'll get a laugh. You got me to laugh.
I didn't didn't mean it. But the that now it's got I can't think. But that's gotta have that feeling, right? Like that's why I had people on or like I have to stop in the middle and drink a juice or like stuff like that. That's why, right?
It would be definitely, and I would expect that it's probably, as you said, more relative to the activity level that the person's already at, right?
Right.
And or in their intimate time with their partner.
How active that gets.
How active that gets or how fast it is or how slow it is or whatever they're doing together, right?
Is this
just
a Thursday or is this a party, right?
Exactly. So is this vacation in Paris or is it like, well, I don't know.
I'll jot that down and send it off to your husband. Paris will get it done.
Oh, we've been there already. Oh, it's all good.
Oh, well, okay. I didn't know it was a memory. Okay.
So not really.
It's hilarious.
That's a really good question because it is something that, again, working with the large amount of women that I work with, it is definitely something that comes up. I don't know that I've ever had that conversation with a gentleman.
Yeah, I have.
But women definitely it's something that gets brought up because it is a consideration. And also, I mean, the consideration of the ability to actually feel good if your blood sugar is sitting at 52 in that type of a setting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably not able to enjoy as much as you should be able to, because not only is your alarm going off, but your brain is not really, there's a whole host of things that are not being focused on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And then on top of that, if you're foggy because you're high or you're dizzy because you're low and Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a good way to end.
Although I never really thought about my exercise preparing.
Well, I mean, you know a lot about it now.
I do.
So if I have type one, And I go to my mate and I say, listen, I've got to get this right. I'm going to need a lot of experience. Jenny told me if I just trial and error, I'll really figure it out. I probably just need 6 months. I'll get it straight. Don't you worry. I just need your help.
I'm quite sure that their mate is going to be like, woohoo. Yeah. Awesome.
Well, let's hope. All right. Thank you for doing this with me. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Mark is an incredible example of what so many experience living with diabetes. You show up for yourself and others every day, never letting diabetes define you. And that is what the Medtronic Champion community is all about. Each of us is strong, and together, we're even stronger. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community, or to share your own story, visit medtronicdiabetes.com/juicebox. Don't forget, we still have Mark's conversation at the very end. It's a terrific kind of mini episode, about 10 minutes long, that goes deeper into some of the things that you heard Mark talking about earlier in the show. A huge thanks to US Med for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box podcast. Don't forget, usmed.com/juicebox. This is where we get our diabetes supplies from. You can as well. Use the link or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or call the number, get your free benefits check so that you can start getting your diabetes supplies the way we do from US Med. A huge thank you to one of today's sponsors, Gvoke Glucagon. Find out more about Gvoke HypoPen at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. You spell that GVOKEGLUCAGON.com/juicebox. If you or a loved one was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and you're looking for some fresh perspective, the Bold Beginnings series from the Juice Box podcast is a terrific place to start. That series is with myself and Jenny Smith. Jenny is a CDCES, a registered dietitian, and a type 1 for over 35 years. And in the Bold Beginnings series, Jenny and I are going to answer the questions that most people have after a type 1 diabetes diagnosis. The series begins at episode 698 in your podcast player, or you can go to juiceboxpodcast.com and click on Bold Beginnings in the menu. And now my full conversation with Medtronic champion, Mark. Mark, how old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I was 28.
28. How old are you now?
47.
47. So just about 20 years?
Yeah, 19 years.
What was your management style when you were diagnosed?
I used injections for about 6 months, and then my endocrinologist in the Navy recommended a pump.
How long had you been in the Navy?
See, 8 years up to that point.
8 years.
Yeah.
I've interviewed a number of people who have been diagnosed during service, and most of the time they're discharged. What happened to you?
I was medically discharged. Yeah, 6 months after my diagnosis.
I don't understand the whole system. Is that like honorable?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, essentially, if you get a medical discharge, you get a commensurate honorable discharge. I guess there could be cases where something other than that, but that's really how it happens. So it's an honorable discharge but because of medical reasons.
And that still gives you access to the VA for the rest of your life, right?
Correct. Yeah, exactly.
Do you use the VA for your management?
Yeah, I used to up until a few years ago when we moved to North Carolina. It just became untenable. Mm-hmm. Just the rigmarole and process to kind of get all the things I needed, you know, for diabetes management. It was far easier just to go through a private practice.
Was it your goal to stay in the Navy for your whole life, your career?
It was. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think a few months before my diagnosis, my wife and I had that discussion about, you know, staying in for the long term. And, you know, we'd made the decision despite all the hardships and time away from home. That was what we loved the most. So that's what made it that much more difficult.
Was the Navy a lifetime goal of yours or something you came to as an adult?
Lifetime goal. I mean, as my earliest childhood memories were flying, being a fighter pilot, and specifically being flying on and off aircraft carriers. So, you know, watching Top Gun in the 80s certainly was a catalyst for that.
You've taken off and landed a jet on an aircraft carrier?
Hundreds of times.
Is there anything in life as exhilarating as that?
No, but there's a roller coaster I rode at, I think it was at Cedar Rapids up in Cleveland, mm-hmm. Sandusky. And they've got this roller coaster that takes you from zero to, I think it's like 80 or something. You go up a big hill and you come right back down. So the acceleration is pretty similar, I would say, to a catapult shot.
I'm going to guess you own a Tesla.
I don't. Okay. I'm a boring guy. I got a hybrid RAV4. I get made fun of. I get called, you know, my wife says I drive like a grandpa. I'm a 5 miles per hour over the speed limit person, no more than that. So yeah, in the car, I'm boring, Scott.
So you've never felt a need to try to replace that with something else?
You can't replace it. It's irreplaceable.
That's what I thought.
So up until the point where someone, you know, buys me an F-18 or allows me to get inside a two-seater and fly it, you can't replace it.
How did it make you feel when you saw, or maybe you haven't seen, a gentleman named Pietro has his large aircraft license. He's flying for a major carrier now. He has type 1 diabetes. Does that feel hopeful to you?
Yeah, it does. You know, when I was diagnosed, that wasn't a possibility. The FAA prohibited commercial pilots who had type 1 diabetes. But I think it was 2017 when they changed their rules to allow type 1 diabetics to be commercial pilots. And part of the reason they did that was because of the technology advancements, specifically in pump therapy and pump management. So I don't have any aspirations of going to the commercial airlines, but one of my sons who has type 1 diabetes very much wants to be a commercial pilot. So, you know, in that respect, I'm very hopeful and thankful.
Yeah. Do you fly privately now for pleasure?
I do. Yeah. One of my favorite things to do is fly my kids to the different soccer tournaments I have all over the Southeast U.S. So last week, my wife and I and two of our boys flew up to Richmond for their soccer tournaments up there. And Charlie, who's my middle child, has type 1 diabetes. So, you know, if I can combine flying, family, and football in one weekend, to me, I think I've just achieved Valhalla.
So then it sounds to me like this diagnosis was a significant course correction for you. Can you tell me how it affected your dream?
Well, I guess three words come to mind. First, it was devastating. Everything I had done in life, everything I'd worked up to that point was just taken away in an instant. And I was not prepared for that at all. The second emotion was it was scary. I hadn't thought much about life outside the Navy, certainly not life as anything else but a fighter pilot. And Heather and I were getting ready to move to France. I was going to do an exchange tour with the French Naval Air Force. So we were taking French classes. So pretty quickly, I had to reinvent myself. And then probably the most important thing at the same time that all that was going on, I had to learn how to deal with type 1 diabetes and how to manage it effectively. The third thing that pops into my mind, I guess, is challenging. You know, new daily routines I had to establish, first with injections and then eventually, you know, through pump management. And then learning how to count carbs and recognize highs and lows, how my body reacts to blood sugar trends based on exercise and stress and those types of things. And my goal at that time, and it still is today, is to leverage technology and make sure my habit patterns are effective so that I take diabetes management from the forefront to the background.
Have you had success with that? Do you feel like you've made the transition well?
I have. I mean, I believe in continuous improvement, so there's always more to do. I will say the technology since I was diagnosed, specifically with pump management, is just, it's just incredible. It takes less of me intervening, and it's really done by the pump itself and by the algorithms through the CGMs. And to me, again, that should be the goal for everybody, is to not have to focus so much on the daily aspects of type 1 diabetes management. You know, we should let technology do that for us.
What else have you found valuable? I've spoken to thousands of people with type 1 diabetes. The one thing that took me by surprise, because I don't have type 1 myself and my daughter was very young when she was diagnosed, I didn't really understand until I launched this podcast and then it grew into this kind of big Facebook presence. I heard people say, I don't know anybody else who has type 1 diabetes. I wish I knew more people. But until I saw them come together, I didn't recognize how important it was.
Yeah, I think similarly, I didn't know anyone with type 1 diabetes growing up as an adult up until when I was diagnosed. And then all of a sudden, people just came out of the woodwork. And when CGMs first hit the market, certainly within the last 5 years, it's amazing to me and my family how many people we've noticed with type 1 diabetes simply because you can see the CGM on their arm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say a month does not go by where we don't run into someone at a restaurant or an amusement park or a sporting event or somewhere where we see somebody else with type 1 diabetes. And the other surprising aspect of that is just how quickly you make friends. And I'll give an example. We were at a soccer tournament up in Raleigh this past Saturday and Sunday, and the referee came over to my son, Charlie, at the end of the game and said, "Hey, I noticed you were wearing a pump." And he lifted up his shirt and showed his pump as well and said, "I've had type 1 diabetes since I was 9 years old. I played soccer in college. I'm sure that's your aspiration. And I just want to tell you, don't let type 1 diabetes ever stop you from achieving your dreams of what you want to do." And this gentleman was probably in his, you know, late 50s or 60s. So just having that connection and seeing, you know, the outreach and people's willingness to share their experiences, it just means the world to us and just makes us feel like we're part of a strong community.
Yeah. So would you say that the most important things are strong technology, tools, understanding how to manage yourself, and a connection to others?
Yeah. Technology for sure, and knowing how to leverage it. And then the community, and that community is your friends, your family, caregivers, you know, for me, the Medtronic Champions community, you know, all those resources that are out there to, you know, help guide the way, but then help you keep abreast on, you know, the new things that are coming down the pipe.
Yeah.
And to give you hope for eventually, you know, that we can find a cure.
You mentioned that your son wanted to be a pilot. He also has type 1 diabetes. How old was he when he was diagnosed?
So Henry was diagnosed when he was 12 years old. That was just at the start of COVID. We were actually visiting my in-laws in Tennessee. We woke up in the morning and he had wet his bed. And several years before that, we had all four of our boys tested for TrialNet. So, you know, predictor of whether or not they're going to develop type 1 diabetes. And Henry and one of his brothers tested positive for a lot of the indicators. So we always kind of had an inclination that there was a high degree of possibility he would develop it, but we always had it in the back of our mind as well. And so when that event happened at the beginning of COVID, we had him take his blood sugar on my glucometer and it was over 400. And so right away we knew that without even being diagnosed properly by an endocrinologist that he was a type 1 diabetic. So we hurried home to get him properly diagnosed in Charlottesville. And then we just started the process. First grieving, but then acceptance and, you know, his eventual becoming part of the team that nobody wants to join.
How old is he now?
Yeah, he's 15 years old now.
When's the first time he came to you and said, "Is this going to stop me from flying?"
Almost immediately. So like me, he always had aspirations of flying. In fact, he, out of all four boys, wanted to be in the military. And that was a difficult part of the conversation and maybe something that we don't talk about as a community, but there are some things you cannot do as a type 1 diabetic, and that's a hard fact of life. And unfortunately, joining the military is one of those hard and fast things. You cannot join the military as a type 1 diabetic. So that was very difficult for him and for me and my wife to get over. Then we also started talking about being a commercial pilot. And so I saw that same excitement in his eyes because, like me, you know, he can be in an F-18 or a 737 or a Cirrus SR-20 that I fly and be just as happy. Yeah. So he still has that passion today and still very much plans to eventually become a commercial pilot.
I appreciate you sharing that with me. Thank you. Do you have four children? Do any others have type 1?
They do. My oldest twin, Henry, has type 1 diabetes, and my middle son, Charlie, has type 1 diabetes as well.
The boys are twins.
The oldest two are twins. One has type 1 diabetes. My middle son, who is not a twin, has type 1 diabetes.
I see. Is there any other autoimmune in your family?
There isn't. I'm really the only person in my family or my wife's family that we know of with any sort of autoimmune disease, certainly type 1 diabetes. So unfortunately, I was the first to strike it rich and unfortunately pass it along to two of my sons.
But celiac, thyroid, anything like that?
Nothing. We're really a pretty healthy family. So this came out of nowhere for myself and for my two sons.
That's really something. I appreciate your time very much, and I appreciate you sharing this with me. Thank you very much.
Anytime, Scott.
Learn more about the Medtronic Champion community at MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or by searching the hashtag Medtronic Champion on your favorite social media platform. If you're not already subscribed or following in your favorite audio app, please take the time now to do that. It really helps the show. And get those automatic downloads set up so you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back very soon with another episode of the Juice Box Podcast. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.